disclaimer. I'm not a lawyer, neither is my partner, Paul Haas. But Paul graduated from the University of Michigan Law School and currently works as a law librarian at George Mason University. Probably everybody in this room knows who this man is and what he accomplished. I'm afraid of this one and not Hall of Fame left-hander Warren Spahn won 363 games. He won 363 games in his brilliant career, more than any other southpaw, and in fact more than any pitcher since World War I. He also combined with Lou Burdette to hurl more victories than any other pair of teammates in the past 100 years. The title listed for this talk is How Warren Spahn Almost Ruined Sabre. That is, of course, hyperbole, borrowed from the playbook of P.T. Barnum and Carl Rove. Spahn had no thought. Spahn had no thought of harming Sabre, and in fact, his actions that might have impacted Sabre occurred before Sabre was born, merely a vague concept in the fertile imagination of L. Robert Davids. Nevertheless, a convoluted chain of events, potentially harmful to baseball biographers, was initiated on April Fool's Day, 1958, when a book entitled The Warren Spahn Story went on sale. It was written by Milton J. Shapiro and published by Julian Messner Incorporated. Mr. Shapiro was a former movie critic and ghostwriter who had once been the sports editor of the National Enquirer. In the span of a decade, he would author nearly a dozen biographies of baseball players, most of them still active at the time. The books targeted the juvenile audience. The first of these was the Sal Langley story, followed by the Warren Spahn story, and here is the Warren Spahn story. Each of these books had 192 pages, and each portrayed its subject, Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Jackie Robinson, Gil Hodges, as a hero who overcame obstacles to achieve success in the big leagues. To make the books dramatic and engaging, Shapiro used, by his own admission, invented dialogue and imaginary incidents. For instance, the Warren Spahn story begins with Spahn and other members of the Army Corps of Engineers under aerial bombardment while working to repair the Ludendorff Bridge near Remagen, Germany, during World War II. The opening paragraph begins, quote, Staff Sergeant Warren E. Spahn glanced anxiously up at the sky as the opening bursts of fire belched from the anti-aircraft guns dug in around Remagen Bridge. Stukas again, he muttered bitterly to himself. Stukas were, of course, German dive bombers. Spahn said that the facts of that paragraph were untrue. He would later testify during cross-examination by defense attorney Philip Wittenberg that he didn't know what kind of planes were attacking them. Question, didn't you even know what the planes were that were attacking you? Answer, no. Didn't anybody ever tell you what they were? We could identify enemy planes from American planes. Were they enemy planes? The answer was yes. So he knew that much. As for muttering Stukas again, he testified, the only thing I might have muttered to myself at that particular time was something about getting under something to hide. Shortly after the book was published, Spahn's mother heard about it and immediately called her son. He bought a copy in the Milwaukee bookstore and read it. He was shocked by fictionalized scenes and factual inaccuracies, believing it was, quote, simply wrong to make up stories about someone. He said the book caused embarrassment and humiliation to him and his family, that the publisher and author had taken pecuniary advantage by creating a work to, quote, thrill, adventurize, amuse, and inspire their reading public, end quote. He hired a New York City attorney and filed suit on July 28, 1958, under New York's civil rights law for invasion of privacy. He requested $175,000 in damages, and sought a permanent injunction against further distribution of the book. By that time, by the time the trial had begun, about 16,000 copies of the book had been sold at $325 each. The case languished in the legal system for more than 5 years before Spahn flew to New York to give testimony on January 24, 1964, before the state Supreme Court.
Two legal points. In most states, the term Supreme Court is reserved for the highest court in the state. In New York, however, the Supreme Court is actually the lowest court. That is, it is the trial court. It's equivalent to what other states generally call circuit courts. Thus, Spahn's case was heard in the Supreme Court of New York County, which people from New York know is Manhattan. The next highest court up in the chain in New York is the Supreme Court Appellate Division, and their highest court is the New York Court of Appeals. Second point, New York historically had no common law right of privacy, and matters in tort are generally matters of common law. In 1903, way back in 1903, the New York legislature passed a law providing a statutory right of privacy under what was called the New York Civil Rights Law, and it was this law upon which Spahn v. Messner was based.
Under questioning from his lawyer, Spahn made his case. The book was filled with untruths and distortions that presented him in a false light. For example, he had suffered an injury while pitching in the minor leagues, but it was to his elbow, not his shoulder, as the book claimed. Because he was a minor, he needed a parent to sign his first contract, but it was his mother, not his father, who signed the contract. His father had been ill in the hospital. Spahn had not received the Bronze Star in the war. By saying that he had, Spahn felt the author had glorified him unjustly to make him appear heroic, and so on. When asked by the defense, Spahn proclaimed that less than 50% of the information in the book was factual. Spahn clearly showed discomfort in regard to scenes from his personal life that Shapiro created in the book. The author had never met Spahn, never spoken with any family member or friend or teammate or anybody who knew Spahn. When he wrote about the Spahn family, he was imagining how they would act in a given situation. In the book, for example, when Spahn returns home from the war, he surprises his wife, Loreen, by announcing, arriving unannounced, ringing the doorbell, then sweeping her off her feet and falling onto the sofa with her, quote, in a laughing tangle. It may have been romantic, but it wasn't Lauren Spahn. In reality, he phoned her first. He met her at the train station. They went out and got something to eat. Spahn's attorney was Earl Warren Zadens, a high-profile Gotham lawyer whose clients included, among others, Billie Holiday and Lenny Bruce. Zadens' obstructionist behavior seemed to match perfectly with the great southpaw's belligerent attitude on the witness stand. In describing his injury at Remagen, Spahn testified, quote, I suddenly realized that my foot was bleeding. The defense attorney asked him, did you fall? Answer, I was running and crawling. Did you fall? No. How did you get to crawl? Just the fact that they were shelling. They don't stand straight up. You said you did not fall. I'm asking you, how did you get to crawl? Answer, for the simple preservation the Army teaches. You fell, didn't you? No, sir. You crawled, yes. But you did not fall? No. Spahn wouldn't agree to anything. Continuing to discuss Remagen, Spahn relentlessly insisted that Shapiro's description was untrue. The book states, quote, the engineers continued their work calmly throughout the bombardment. Sergeant Spahn going from man to man, urging them on, though he knew they needed no reminding. It isn't true, Spahn declared under oath. I didn't go man to man. Question, is that the part, man to man? Answer, yes. Do you doubt that you went among your men encouraging them at all? I don't doubt that. What does that say, except that you went encouraging your men? Why do you call a thing untrue because you found it man to man in it? Answer, it embellishes a fact. Later on, Winford, the exasperated defense attorney, told the judge, quote, I am now cross-examining to prove that this witness cannot be trusted for the truth. The response attorney moved to strike that remark. Wittenberg snapped, I want it on the record. His honor may reprimand me, but he cannot strike my record. After many hours of objections, interrupted by occasional testimony, Judge Jacob Markowitz rendered his verdict on May 28, 1964. And you can tell from the photo how it came out. He ruled in favor of Mr. Spahn, awarding him $10,000 in damages and enjoining publication and further distribution of the Warren Spahn story. Judge Markowitz found that, quote, the record unequivocally establishes that the book publicizes areas of Warren Spahn's personal and private life, albeit inaccurate and filled with distortions, factual errors, and fanciful passages. At that moment, the authors of baseball biographies, stood in serious jeopardy. Now here's a short sidebar. Spahn pitched that afternoon for the Milwaukee Braves at County Stadium. He gave up 4 runs in 8 innings and lost to the Houston Colt 45. Predictably, the author and the publisher appealed the decision. On May 18, 1965, after re-arguing the case, the appellate court affirmed the judgment of the trial court. It was another win for Spahn. So everything seemed to be going well for him. But 2 days later, the once great lefty, now a New York Met, gave up a grand slam to Eddie Matthews and lost in County Stadium. Again, the losing defendants appealed. On September 23, 1965, just hours after the Milwaukee Braves' last home game ever, the highest court in New York State, which is not the Supreme Court, as you know, refused to review the lower court's ruling, another Spahn victory. Again, the losing defendants appealed.
On October 27, 1966, the New York Court of Appeals affirmed the New York Supreme Court's opinion, concluding that the defendants' publication of a fictitious biography of the plaintiff constitutes an unauthorized exploitation of his personality for purposes of trade in violation of New York civil rights law. The New York Court's unanimous decision was written by Kenneth Keating. Keating, a moderate Republican at a time when there was such a thing. A former congressman and then senator from New York who refused to endorse Barry Goldwater's presidential candidacy in 1964 and lost his Senate seat to Robert Kennedy. Keating, incidentally, had various connections to baseball. In the 1950s, he and Brooklyn Congressman Emanuel Seller threatened antitrust action against Major League Baseball if it televised games nationally as planned because it jeopardized the minor leagues. Remember, New York had lost 2 of its teams then. In 1960, he assured the backers of the proposed Continental League of congressional support. And the third connection he had was after he was defeated in 1964, he was frequently mentioned as a successor to Ford Frick as Commissioner of Baseball when Frick's term expired in 1965.
Spahn's repeated victories in the courtroom did not go unnoticed in the baseball world. Other ballplayers who had been subjects of unauthorized biographies suddenly felt they too had suffered anguish from fictitious versions of their life stories. 2 athletes, Hank Aaron, I caught him then, and Don Drysdale, appeared in books written by Milton Shapiro. Eddie Matthews' life had been penned by longtime Boston sports writer Al Hirschberg. Following Spahn's example, all 3 of these all-star players retained Earl Warren Zatins as their legal counsel. Having exhausted the New York system of jurisprudence, the oft-defeated defendants sought relief from the United States Supreme Court. This case had already taken so long that Spahn, about whom Stan Musial had once said, "I don't think he'll ever get into the Hall of Fame, he'll never stop pitching."
The 9-0 man of the U.S. Supreme Court, in light of two relatively recent rulings, remanded Spahn v. Messner to the New York Court of Appeals. One of the two pertinent decisions was New York Times v. Sullivan. The Sullivan ruling said the Constitution prevents public officials from receiving damages from critics of their official conduct unless the plaintiff can prove actual malice. Spahn was not a public official and his actions were not official conduct.
The other and more important standard-setting case was Kine, Hink v. Hill. In 1952, three escaped convicts invaded the Pennsylvania home of James Hill, his wife, and their five children, holding them hostage for 19 hours before fleeing. A year later, a novel entitled The Desperate Hours was published based on the incident. In 1954, the story was produced as a Broadway play starring Paul Newman. The playwright took artistic license to portray the event as more threatening and violent than it had actually been. The real convicts treated the family courteously. When the drama debuted on the stage, Life magazine ran a story calling the theater version a reenactment of the family's ordeal. The article included photos of the actors in the house where the family had lived at the time. And here's another sidebar. The exterior shots of the family, this is Humphrey Bogart as the villain, the exterior shots used the same house as the opening sequence of Leave It to Beaver. James Hill successfully sued Life magazine's parent company, Time Inc., for connecting his family with a work of fiction, claiming a violation of privacy. Of course, the media giant appealed immediately, reaching the U.S. Supreme Court. The Hill family's case was argued by Richard Nixon in his only appearance before the Supreme Court. Nixon argued that the fictionalization aspect of privacy law did not impinge on freedom of expression. A deeply divided court by a 5-4 margin rejected Nixon's contention and found in favor of Time Inc.
In view of the standards set by Time Inc. v. Hill, the U.S. Supreme Court remanded the Spahn case to the New York Court of Appeals to reconsider. The appeals court reheard the case, reaffirmed its earlier decision in favor of Spahn. This time, however, very interestingly, it was not unanimous, which it had been the first time around. It was decided 4-2. Justice Francis Bergen wrote the dissenting opinion, joined by Justice Stanley Fuld, saying that it was quite obvious that the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed with the New York Court of Appeals opinion, and that's why they remanded it for consideration in light of Time v. Hill. Once more, the defendants appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming an unconstitutional restraint. The Supreme Court requested briefs from both sides. The field of law, however, like the field of baseball, is full of strange bounces. In mid-January, attorneys for Spahn, Messner, and Shapiro agreed out of court to ask the U.S. Supreme Court for dismissal. Spahn agreed to vacate his $10,000 award, and the publisher agreed not to reprint the Warren Spahn story. But they could publish a revised story about Spahn that would be free of knowing falsity and reckless disregard for the truth. Finally, the suits of Henry Aaron, Eddie Matthews, and Don Drysdale were dismissed with prejudice without costs to either party.
The Hall of Fame Southpaw later told University of Tulsa law professor Ray Yasser, quote, "I litigated the damn case forever. I ended up paying my lawyers a ton, but I made my point." Whether or not he made his point is a matter of opinion. Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas stated that in clarifying an individual's right of privacy, quote, "the most important recent case is Spahn v. Messner, Inc." Justice William Brennan, commenting on the great left-hander's legal odyssey, proclaimed, quote, "as Spahn the case indicates, the published matter need not be defamatory, might even be laudatory and still warrant recovery. Spahn's initial damage award had been upheld. Had it been upheld, thank you. Might have had a chilling effect on sports literature. Instead, unauthorized biographies can continue almost unabated. Spahn, meanwhile, remains in all likelihood the only plaintiff in the history of American justice to file suit for being praised when he didn't deserve it.
Thank you.